Okay, good morning, everybody. So we are beginning Chapter 5 of Book 2, Part 1, The Life Divine. And in the PDF version, this is page, I believe it's 428.
Yeah, that's what I have, page 428.
So I think last time we read the beginning, but we'll start from again. This chapter is called The Cosmic Illusion, Mind, Dream, and Hallucination. And as we can see, in this part, this book, two part one, Sri Aurobindo is proceeding to lay out the conditions of knowledge. It's his section on what is called epistemology. How do we arrive at knowledge? Or what kind of knowledge can we have? And how are we to validate this knowledge? These are the primary questions. And after establishing the idea of a reality that is fundamentally indeterminate, but determining itself through its own choices, and one in which emergent evolution is occurring from a condition of bondage to a condition of the recognition of its absolute freedom. He is laying out the territory in terms of a number of dualities. So we found the duality of the eternal and the individual. And last chapter that we considered was the divine and the undivine. And here too, he is actually going to lay it out in terms of a duality. And the duality, the basis of that duality is the confusion regarding what is and what is not. And it rests on the fact that we find ourselves in a world which we experience and interact with through the medium of the senses. And that is primarily what gives us knowledge. So the conditions of knowledge come to us through a certain given, the world or cosmos, on an objective side, but also a certain given, which is the apparatus of knowledge of sensing and cognition on the subjective side. And this yields a certain duality, which only in a certain kind of a simplistic sense we can forget if we assume the reality of the world. But if we question that reality, we find ourselves in a great confusion, because it doesn't seem that there is any datum for validating which side of this duality is true. So this is what he's going to field in this particular chapter, and extend his metaphysical framework to test it against this duality. So with that, we can begin, unless there is any discussion or comments that anybody would like to make.
Do we want to read the paragraph again or start with the next?
No, let's start from the beginning again.
Sure.
Because we didn't discuss any of it last time.
Yes.
We might as well start with the preamble and move into the first paragraph.
Sure. Joanna, would you like to start?
I'm sorry, I'm not going to read. I'm going to have to drop off in just a few minutes
to
a class of mine. So I'll read next time. Thanks.
Yeah. Matteo, you want to go?
Okay. So this is book two, The Knowledge and the Ignorance, The Spiritual Evolution, part one, The Infinite Consciousness and the Ignorance, chapter five, The Cosmic Illusion, Mind, Dream, and Hallucination. Thou who hast come to this transient and unhappy world, turn to me, Gita. This self is a self of knowledge, an inner light in the heart. He is the conscious being, common to all the states of being, and moves in both worlds. He becomes a dream self and passes beyond this world and its forms of death. There are two planes of this conscious being, this and the other worlds. A third state is their place of joining, the state of dream. And when he stands in this place of their joining, he sees both planes of his existence, this world and the other world. When he sleeps, he takes the substance of this world, in which all is and himself undoes and himself builds by his own illumination, his own light. When this conscious being sleeps, he becomes luminous with his self-light. There are no roads, nor chariots, nor joys, nor pleasures, nor tanks, nor ponds, nor rivers, but he creates them by his own light, for he is the maker. By sleep, he casts off his body, and unsleeping sees those that sleep. He preserves by his life breath this lower nest and goes forth immortal from his nest. Immortal, he goes where he wills, the golden Purusha, the solitary swan. They say the country of waking is, they say the country of waking only is his. For the things which he sees when awake, these only he sees when asleep. But there he is his own self-light. Brihadaranyaka, Upanishad. What is seen and what is not seen? What is experience and what is not experience? What is and what is not? All it sees. It is all and sees. Prashna Upanishad. All human thought, all mental man's experience moves between a constant affirmation and negation. There is, for his mind, no truth of idea, no result of experience that cannot be affirmed, none that cannot be negated. It has negated the existence of the individual being, negated the existence of the cosmos, negated the existence of any immanent or underlying reality, negated any reality beyond the individual and the cosmos. But it is also constantly affirming these things, sometimes one of them solely or any two or all of them together? It has to do so because our thinking mind is in its very nature an ignorant dealer in possibilities, not possessing the truth behind any of them, but sounding and testing each in turn or many together, if so, perchance it may get at some settled belief or knowledge about them, some certitude. Yet, living in a world of relativities and possibilities, it can arrive at no final certainty, no absolute and abiding conviction. Even the actual, the realized, can present itself to our mentality as a maybe or may not be, siyad va na siyad va, or as an is under the shadow of the might not have been, and wearing the aspect of that which will not be hereafter. Our life being is also afflicted by the same incertitude. It can rest in no aim of living from which it can derive a sure or final satisfaction, or to which it can assign an enduring value. Our nature starts from facts and actualities, which it takes for real. It is pushed beyond them into a pursuit of uncertain possibilities and led eventually to question all that it took as real. For it proceeds from a fundamental ignorance and has no hold on assured truth. All the truths on which it relies for a time are found to be partial, incomplete, and questionable.
So as is his wont, Sri Aurobindo lays the problem out in a most profound manner from the very outset. So he begins with those quotations, and I must commend Matteo for a beautiful reading, very evocative, as kind of in keeping with the spirit of the words. So there we find that the quotations that he gives us are taken from one from the Gita. The one from the Gita actually lays out what one might call a more vital apprehension, intuition of this duality, in the sense that it touches at the raw nerve of our suffering in this world, this transient and unhappy world. So it's putting us into contact with something which makes us recognize the insufficiency and problematic nature of our experience in this world. But at the same time, this is Sri Aurobindo's method, which is that if we experience something, even the fact of the experience or the knowledge of insufficiency means that there is a striving in us for going beyond it. The seeking for a solution, or the intuition of a solution that we must find beyond the condition that we are not happy with. And so there, it's feeling this duality in terms of this vital experience, and it's overcoming in terms of a surrender to the Supreme. So it really kind of cuts at the knot of our experience in terms of this evolution from ignorance and falsehood to the truth out of which it came. The other two quotations come from the Upanishads. And the first one comes from one of the oldest Upanishads, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which means the Upanishad of the vast forest, and connects it with what are called the forest texts, the Aranyakas. And a lot of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is written in the key of a transcendence, of a recognition of the, what one might say, illusory nature of the empirical world and the need to transcend it. So this long quote is very powerful. And its themes are taken up in a number of other Upanishads as well. I mean, note that those two quotes, the one from the Brihadaranyaka and the one from the Prashna, get to the heart of the problem of knowledge, which in the Indian philosophical tradition is a problem of sight. Of course, we may think of that in an oversimplified way. The problem of sight is really the problem of darshan. And so to see is to know. Now, in the Vedic sense, when Sri Aurobindo looks at this, when we talk about seeing, we are actually turning the problem of knowledge into the key of sight, the eye, E-Y-E, I mean. But there are two primary senses through which the highest knowledge becomes objective. So it is as if in this turning from undifferentiated self-knowledge, essential knowledge, to the knowledge by which the infinite being can know itself as description, can objectify itself. It is as if there are two simultaneous faculties that become the doors of that description. And they are sight and hearing. So this is the reason why Ila and Saraswati are the two primary goddesses. One is the goddess of sight or revelation, and the other is the goddess of hearing or becoming, and that is Saraswati, thought of in the key of hearing. Shruti, darshan and shruti, these are the two primary modalities of knowledge. One pertains to knowledge in terms of seeing, understanding, cognition in an essential way, and the other pertains to knowledge of action, of becoming, of receiving in a temporal flow the skills of intuition to deal with things. So here, the Upanishads are largely a body of texts that concern themselves with knowledge in the key of seeing, even more than the other knowledge in the key of action. They are wisdom texts of knowledge as cognition. So that's the reason why there is this emphasis on seeing in both these quotations. This self is a self of knowledge, an inner light in the heart. So it starts off, and this is very interesting, because in the Upanishads, the organ of knowledge is placed in the heart. This we find even in other Upanishads, like the Aitareya Upanishad, for example, when knowledge blossoms from the heart of the Purusha. So this inner light in the heart, so again, light is that by which we see, that which makes the conditions of seeing possible. And we'll find that repeatedly in the Upanishads, there is this question of what is the light by which everything is seen. And that light is given to us as something which is not the light of the sun or the light of the moon or the light of fire or the light of lightnings. See, these are the four kinds of light. But something by which, something which kindles all these lights, something by which all these lights are originated. You know, Sri Aurobindo says in Savitri, the light, the sun from which we kindle all our suns. So this is the inner light, the light which is the origin, which arises in the heart, in the sense that whether we look at it from the viewpoint of Purusha's self-knowledge or the viewpoint of the individuals arriving at the knowledge of the Purusha, it is coming from a deep intuition that light is shining from deep within the heart, from the center of immanence. He is the conscious being common to all the states of being and moves in both worlds. So here we find that this is a very powerful and interesting clause, because from the get-go, we are being told that there may be many worlds or states of being. All the states of being. So it immediately is relativizing whatever state of being we are finding ourselves in. And then it is talking of two worlds, both worlds. So without really defining them, and then we'll see this kind of idea is elaborated further in later Upanishads. The most important one of these that deals with this particular theme and whose echo one might find throughout this chapter is the Upanishad of the frog, the Mandukya Upanishad. And in that Upanishad, the states of being, as he says, all the states of being are spelt out. And there the states of being are given as four, the avasthas. Avastha is a state of being. And these are the waking, the sleeping or dreaming, the dreamless sleep, as we sometimes translate it, but it isn't a very good translation. It is more like the sleep in sleep, and then the fourth, nameless state. And when he comes down and says, and moves in both worlds, he's referring to the first two, the waking and the dreaming states. Because these are the two states that are readily available to all human beings and maybe all living creatures in their normal experience. But as some of the Upanishads will make clear, there is another Upanishad, the Mundaka Upanishad. And then there are other texts like the text of Ashtavakra, which will talk about these two states as states that automatically, if we contemplate them, yield the relativity of all states. If we really contemplate our existence, and this is what this chapter will do, it will bring us into that contemplation. What is true? Waking or dream, this becomes one way by which we enter into this, you know, consideration. It is only because it's a common and shared reality in waking, and one which has a certain continuity, that we give it greater reality and value than the reality of dream, which seems to be discontinuous. But the vividness of dreams, while we have them, if given their due worth, would make it clear that they pertain to a reality by themselves. And at times, this reality becomes so compelling that we are left wondering which of these two is real. And this becomes the beginning of some forms of interrogation. The Ashtavakra Gita and the Mundaka deal with this not only through dream, but through other exceptional states of experience, like that of trance or of extraordinary subjective states through which we may actually experience many lifetimes of the kind that we experience in this life, but transposed into the key of a small span of external time. And when things of that nature happen, then we are left wondering, what is the truth of experience? It is the same kind of experience and the same intensity of experience, but it is a different state of experience. So in those two, this kind of texts, this kind of consideration is made the basis of positing a condition beyond all states, because if there are two states, there may even be other states. This is also a Taoist consideration, the consideration of Chuang Tzu, who wonders if we are dreaming that which we see, or we are being dreamed by somebody or something else. So this is the idea of all the states of being, which we can intuit if we relativize these two states of being, which are common to our experience. Both of them become equally true or equally false. And then we are left asking the question, are there an eternal succession of states of being? And what is true? So here it is affirming that there is a conscious being common to all the states of being that inhabits these states, as it were. These states are the states of one being. And then it takes up these two states. He becomes a dream self and passes beyond this world and its forms of death. So here we, encounter the first quotation again, that this world, the world we take to be more true than the world of dream, the objective world, which repeats itself every time we wake from sleep with a persistence and a logic that grounds us in a common existence, and that has a certain inevitability to it, certain patterns that repeat, beginnings and ends, births and deaths, that this world, which we are seeking for in terms of external knowledge or objective knowledge, because we can describe things in terms of laws that don't go away, we can unwind this world. See, as he says, we can pass beyond this world and its forms of death. It specifically refers to the forms of death, because that is the vital source of our suffering, as he says, this transient and unhappy world. We pass beyond it, and we can relativize it. We can ask the question as to whether all that we experience and all those others we encounter who experience the same world, as to whether all of it is a dream, because it's all dependent on our own state of experiencing. And if we do that, then we can flip over into the subjective world, and this world becomes unreal or becomes relativized, and we move into the dream state, the dream self. Then they feel the two worlds. There are two planes of this conscious being. So again, now we are seeing that instead of talking about two states of existence, it's putting these states of existence in relation to the being that experiences these states. There are two planes of this conscious being, this and the other worlds. These worlds are the worlds that one might encounter. In other words, it tells us that the world of dream is itself a layered world. The state of dream contains many worlds in it. So too, our experience of dream may take on a variety of characters. It may be a ranging through many states with different laws and different kinds of logic. Two planes, this and the other worlds. And then it posits the third. A third state is that place of joining the state of dream. So this third state, which is the place, their place of joining, and here he calls it the state of dream, because as I said, the true translation of the third state, even in the Mandukya Upanishad, is the sleep within the sleep. In other words, it's a third state of dreaming from which these two are being dreamt out, as it were. The waking and the sleeping are being dreamt out. And it so transcends both these states of being. It's the joining of these states. And when he stands in this place of their joining, he sees both planes of his existence, this world and the other world. So your waking and dreaming become both relative states that relate to each other, but that emerge from this transcendental state of dreaming. In other words, dreaming over here as a conscious dream, a conscious creation, just like a poet creating a poem, with a virtual realm in terms of the possibilities of the poem and the concrete realm in terms of the actualization of those possibilities. Both these are states of being. When he sleeps, he takes the substance of this world in which all is, and himself undoes and himself builds by his own illumination. So this sleep, again, we can see it in terms of two successive jumps, you know, like the jumps of the frog, you know, that's why it's called the Upanishad of the frog. Discontinuous jumps from waking to sleep and sleep to greater sleep, as it were. Each of these jumps into sleep is one in which the substance of the world is abstracted by one other level. We go into a state of essential reality. And therefore we undo what were the determinants of a more concrete world and arrive at the indeterminates of the more essential world. And from there we can rebuild, or we can build, or we can recognize the fact that this is an extension, a building. Then we are no longer bound by the construction. So this is a way by which we are being told that that which has created the conditions of the objective world does so from a state of freedom, and we can experience that state of freedom through this progressive inversion of consciousness. And then we find that we are the creator, that himself builds by his own illumination, his own light. And here again, the reference to light. It is as if, what are the conditions of seeing? Conditions of seeing ultimately are some tattva or element by which sight becomes possible. Knowledge becomes possible. Any description becomes possible only by this base element or tattva that is called light. And hence, light itself has different manifestations in these states of being and is the threshold condition for their appearance, as it were. And it is seen that this originary light, his own light, the light by which all other lights shine, is that which builds, that itself is the builder. When this conscious being sleeps, he becomes luminous with his self-light. This is again this notion of the deepest, or maybe the fourth state of being, Turiya, in which there is a, even from the sleeping within sleep, there is the unmanifest transcendence, where there is, you know, there's a place which Sri Aurobindo says, there where the seer sleeps in too much light, you know, there's a excess of light, because it's light which is folded into light. That is the self-light by which luminosity is the origin of this ocean of light, which is the origin of all objective seeing, understanding of knowledge, the root of knowledge. There are no roads, nor chariots, nor joys, nor pleasures, nor tanks, nor ponds, nor rivers. These are all both objective and subjective conditions. These things and these states, like joys and pleasures, they are all emanations of this light and the power of creation. Creativity working through this itself light. But he creates them by his own light, for he is the maker. So this is the Purusha as the one that gives form, who creates, who makes. By sleep he casts off his body, and unsleeping sees those that sleep. So again, it's a repeat of the fact that the body, and again we can think of a succession of bodies, okay, that this body which we take to be so real is really a form of consciousness. It is a structure of consciousness. And we can move into a more elementary structure. We can move to the body without organs, as a contemporary philosopher refers to it. So we move into that. We cast off this body, and unsleeping sees those that sleep. So that's the condition from which there is full consciousness of the states of formation, of construction. He preserves by his life breath this lower nest. And so here is the notion that here we come to yoga, and this is the statement is becoming shamanistic here. There is suddenly a move from this quasi-philosophical language to the language of the Veda, a language of poetry and of mystic metaphor. He preserves by his breath the lower, this lower nest, in other words, the state of objective reality. It's preserved by the lower, by the breath, by his life breath. In other words, there is a way by which we can maintain our connection with the world. We don't need to sunder the experience of the objective world or the subjective world, but keep these experiences going by an act of consciousness, which is a yogic act. That's the preservation by the life breath. And then the truth of this being, the freedom of this being becomes evident, self-evident, and it jumps to the great Vedic image of the swan. Immortal, he goes where he wills, and the Purusha, the golden Purusha, the solitary swan. This is the Paramhansa, the supreme swan, that not only knows how to discriminate in this world so that it tastes only the truth, but is called so because he can fly freely, ranging through all these states of being. It climbs up and down the ladder of existence of the states. They say the country of waking only is his. So this, the country of waking only, it's always awake. There is no, so here the relativity of waking and sleeping is suddenly collapsed into a state of perpetual waking, a state of everlasting day, you may say. The country of waking only is his. He is only and always awake. For the things which he sees when awake, these only he sees when asleep. So sleeping is also only a form of waking. It wakes into its own sleep, as it were. But there he is his own self-light. Into that sleeping, he is his own self-light. So it's another form of his own waking. So this is a very profound meditation. Extremely profound meditation, mystic meditation, that Sri Aurobindo, you know, immerses us in at the very beginning of his chapter, so as to give us a entry into the meditation that he will take us through. And then this entire complex idea is again simplest, one may say, into this kind of one line from the Prashna Upanishad. What is seen and what is not seen? Okay, the actual and the virtual. The actual, which is what we are experiencing, but all its background of infinity from which it emerges, that is not seen. What is experienced and what is not experienced? What is and what is not? All it sees, it is all and sees. Again, it's the same. It's like the golden Purusha and the solitary swan that is the origin of radical infinity, of all possibilities, and brings them into a certain configuration of being by the power of its creative intelligence, see, which is the supermind. Okay. So I think that's how he feels this very profound chapter. And then the first paragraph, he puts us in doubt of the nature of our knowledge, which is mental knowledge. Mental knowledge, as he says in Savitri, is turbaned with a doubt. It, whatever we may think, may be true or may not be true. And we can argue equally in both directions. And this is why he quotes the Jains, that particular little phrase, Syadva na Syadva, is a Jain statement of the Jains, of Jainism, which maintains a certain kind of agnosticism with regard to knowledge, and that makes it possible for them to claim a status of understanding which is called Anekantavyad, Vad. Anekantavad means, you know, plural notions of knowledge. That is absolute relativity regarding the forms of our understanding. Any kind of idea that we may have is only relatively true. So that is the notion that he's referring to there. And that idea of the relativity of mental knowledge is what he feels in that first paragraph. For it proceeds from a fundamental ignorance, as has no hold on assured truth. All the truths on which it relies for a time are found to be partial, incomplete, and questionable. So if there are any questions, comments, we can consider or move on.
Quick question and a comment.
Sure, Mathieu.
Does Mandukya, is Mandukya Sanskrit for frog?
Yeah. Manduka is Sanskrit for frog, and Mandukya means of the frog.
Mm.
The frogs of, Upanishad.
Of or off?
Pardon?
Of or off?
O-F means, of the frog. The frogs Upanishad.
Thank you. And then I suppose I probably have 1,000 comments, but I'll limit it to one. The correlate of all of this is in Savitri, Book 11, The Everlasting Day, where death has been transformed and then starts taking on the states of the fourfold being that are all correlated here, where we have Virat as waking consciousness, Jagrat, lighting fires in the sun, and then in comes Hiranyagarbha, Swapna, or dream state, where it's not a physical dream, but a yogic dream state. And then in comes Ishwara as Sushupta, or dream sleep, and then Brahman as the Turiya. It's just so beautiful to be looking at this in the life divine as a rational argument, and then have that mantra to experience all these states firsthand.
True. Very true. This moment of becoming confused about the waking and the dreaming and the dreaming, and thereby arising to this relativizing of the states of consciousness and awakening to the third and the fourth state of consciousness is staged in a number of places in the Indian writings. And later you'll find in the Puranas and even in the Bhagavad Purana, you'll find moments when it's dramatized. It's actually staged in some particular episode where suddenly this experience will occur and there'll be awakening to the truth of the Purusha or the Purushottama, the Brahman.
I have a comment. I've always had a very, very vivid dream life. So much so that sometimes I can't distinguish between if I experienced something in, quote, waking life, or if it was that I experienced it when I was dreaming. And, you know, there's been times that I've really thought, like, did that really happen, or is it just something I had dreamt about? But then I've also thought, does it really matter because I've had the experience of it, whether it was a dream or it was during waking life? So I kind of understand a bit of that, what he's saying here. But I've always also been fascinated by people who don't remember their dreams. Because dreaming for me is such a big part of my life, and I things are revealed to me in my dreams sometimes that maybe I had been thinking about on an unconscious level, that they become more visible in my dream, and it shows me something like a solution or another aspect to something I hadn't thought of consciously. So I really actually look forward to my dreams. And if I don't remember them in the morning, which isn't occasionally, I won't remember a dream, and I almost feel like something's missing a bit if I don't have that experience. Mm-hmm. But it rather fascinates me that I've known people who will say that they don't remember their dreams.
Right. Many people don't remember dreams, Janet. And the mother says that it's because there are gaps of consciousness. And there's a sudden drop into the objective world, into the world of waking. And the thread between the dreaming and the waking is not sufficiently developed. And one can consciously try to develop that. Or there are people who have a very vivid daydream, you know, experience or world, state of experience. And what you're talking about regarding kind of this relationship between the two, where it's as if certain kinds of more essential forms of understanding relating to the waking world are, you know, contained in dream. This is the whole notion of the other worlds, as he says, into the worlds that are behind our the screen of our objective existence, the entire, you know, domain of the inner or the subjective or the subliminal consciousness. This is what, you know, can be contacted by a variety of means. Dreaming is the most, you know, it's the given, you know, in all experience. All living beings kind of have some state of dream, because so that is part of the habitual given of our existence, you know, to straddle these two states of being, as it were. And then there are other ways by which we can, either in extraordinary states or consciously, enter into these subliminal worlds through, you know, say, trance or meditation or an active daydream life, or a life as a poet or a creative person. Those kinds of states put us also into contact with the same subliminal world into which we habitually enter when we sleep.
This is Justin. I would like to ask, please, if there is a sense in the Mandukya Upanishad of the importance of, or from this passage, of any importance given to any one state, a conscious state, dreaming state, dreamless sleep state, and then, but it seems that the emphasis is on the integral union of all these states going on at the same time. But is there an importance to having even a dreaming state if one is able to be, or is one necessarily having to have dream state to get to the integral consciousness?
Yeah, it's a very profound question, because it'll actually be the question that will determine many paths in the history of the Indian spiritual tradition. And in fact, these very Upanishads will be interpreted in a variety of ways later. And in fact, a kind of major tradition will arise. I would also even go to so far as to say a hegemonic tradition will arise, which privileges the fourth state over the other three states. And so this is going to yield the entire tradition that kind of gives the highest importance to a kind of the deep sort of trance of the fourth state, that that's the only way by which we can come out of the determinants of the other three states. And this is true. That is the state of ultimate freedom. But as he says over there, that is the state also of sleeping in one's own light. See, as he says, you know, that state, where he says, trying to see that. When he sleeps, he takes the substance of this world in which all is, and himself undoes and himself builds by his own illumination. Okay, that's he builds. When this conscious being sleeps, he becomes luminous with his self-light. So this is really the ultimate state. Every internal state is a state in which there is a greater sort of undoing and a greater entry into the infinitude of the unmanifest light, as it were, the sleeping in light. And so in the fourth state, if one privileges that over the three states, then one is really moving into the Vidya with a capital V. And the Upanishads are going to take pains actually to point out that that's not really the goal. One has to arrive there, like you said, Justin, that for the integral condition, one has to know the absolute freedom. But one also has to know that one possesses not merely the property of freedom, of being, but also the property of freedom of becoming. So he is the maker. He is the creator. That's what's being said again and again. And he recognizes the fact that he is free to range through all these conditions of being, not privileging any one of them. In other words, it's not really the state of being that is privileged, but he who is that is privileged, the conscious being that is privileged, who actually moves through these states of being. So I think recognizing that is, and that's why the golden Purusha, and it's always the agent who moves through these states that ultimately wears these states or extends these states out of his own being. So that is the integral view privileging in the sense that that's the interpretation, and it's clear that the Upanishads are moving in that direction, trying to make that the key of understanding these states.
Thank you. A couple more comments. It's interesting, the Mandukya looks at these four states in terms of the microcosm, and then the Chandogya Upanishad brings in all four of these states in terms of the microcosm and then adds them in terms of the macrocosm. It's really beautiful to look at these two Upanishads next to each other and watch that play back and forth. And then another comment just on knowledge. I was confused for years about knowledge and epistemological definitions in philosophy. And then something Sri Aurobindo, I think, cleared my confusion from a definition in the Renaissance in India, where he defines knowledge. He says, and I'm reading here, what we mean in yoga by knowledge and the effort after knowledge is a concentration which culminates in a living realization and the constant sense of the presence of the One in ourselves and in all of which we are aware. And this for me brought knowledge from an abstraction into that basic yogic realization of the One in myself and the One in everything that I perceive, and striving after that rather than thinking about knowledge and for me, because I don't have any training in philosophy and kind of somewhat confusing dissertations on epistemology, it really rooted the term of knowledge in something tangible and workable.
Yeah, very beautiful, Matteo. I'd encourage you to send us a post, that quote that you just read out, and also the passage from the Chandogya that you're referring to. It would be nice if you can send it. Maybe it can be put out on the True Person site and shared so that we all have it.
Ah, okay.
This little phrase over here, kind of where Sri Aurobindo says in that first paragraph about the affirming and the negating, he says it has to do so because our thinking mind is in its very nature an ignorant dealer in possibilities, not possessing the truth behind any of them, but sounding and testing each in turn or many together, if so perchance it may get at some settled belief of knowledge about them, some certitude. So it's very interesting that his use of words there, an ignorant dealer in possibilities. Now, of course, dealer, he means it from a certain point of view as one who deals in the sense of handles. But dealer has other connotations as well. A dealer is one who disseminates, who deals out a hand, as it were, of cards. Or a dealer is even more commonly a trader, one who pushes. See, so a dealer with possibilities, a dealer in possibilities, is one who knows he's ignorant, but at the same time is you know, busy proselytizing his ignorance. It's one of the great paradoxes of human life, you know, how we convince ourselves by convincing others of our own ignorance. You know, it brought to my mind a very beautiful painting, which I don't know if any of you have seen, by a modern Bengali artist called Ganesh Pine, who has a painting called The Merchant of Dreams. And in that painting, you see a person with a bag over his shoulder in the night. And he has gray eyes and looks sort of wizened, you know, and gray. But he's basically trying to sell his bag of dreams to people. And it's a kind of a ambiguous, very ambiguous image, because there is truth and falsehood mixed in it, as it were.
Janet, would you like to read next?
Sure. At the outset, man lives in his physical mind, which perceives the actual, the physical, the objective, and accepts it as fact, and this fact as self-evident truth beyond question. Whatever is not actual, not physical, not objective, it regards as unreal or unrealized, only to be accepted as entirely real when it has succeeded in becoming actual, becoming a physical fact, becoming objective. Its own being, too, it regards as an objective fact, warranted to be real by its existence in a visible and sensible body. All other subjective beings and things it accepts on the same evidence, insofar as they can become objects of our external consciousness, or acceptable to that part of the reason which builds upon the data supplied by that consciousness and relies upon them as the one solid basis of knowledge. Physical science is a vast extension of this mentality. It corrects the errors of the sense and pushes beyond the first limitations of the sense mind by discovering means of bringing facts and objects not seizable by our corporeal organs into the field of objectivity. But it has the same standard of reality, the objective, the physical actuality. Its test of the real is possibility of verification by positive reason and objective evidence. Do you want me to continue or should I stop there?
I think stop there, Janet, because the next paragraph is quite long. I think maybe why don't you continue on second thought, because you know, I think this short paragraph becomes more elaborated by the next paragraph, which takes it into the life mind, as you may.
Okay. Okay.
So let's read the two paragraphs together.
Okay. But man also has a life mind, a vital mentality which is an instrument of desire. This is not satisfied with the actual. It is a dealer in possibilities. It has the passion for novelty and is seeking always to extend the limits of experiences for the satisfaction of desire, for enjoyment, for an enlarged self-affirmation and aggrandizement of its terrain of power and profit. It desires, enjoys, possesses actualities, but it hunts also after unrealized possibilities, is ardent to materialize them, to possess and enjoy them also. It is not satisfied with the physical and objective only, but seeks too a subjective and imaginative, a purely emotive satisfaction and pleasure. If there were not this factor, the physical mind of man left to itself would live like the animal, accepting his first actual physical life and its limits as his whole possibility, moving in material nature's established order and asking for nothing beyond it. But this vital mind, this unquiet life will, comes in with its demands and disturbs this inert or routine satisfaction which lives penned within the bounds of actuality. It enlarges always desire and craving, creates a dissatisfaction, an unrest, a seeking for something more than what life seems able to give it. It brings about a vast enlargement of the field of physical actuality by the actualization of our unrealized possibilities, but also a constant demand for more and always more, a quest for new worlds to conquer, an incessant drive towards an exceeding of the bounds of circumstance and self-exceeding. To add to this cause of unrest and incertitude, there comes in a thinking mind that inquires into everything, questions everything, builds up affirmations and unbuilds them, erects systems of certitude, but finally accepts none of them as certain, affirms and questions the evidence of the senses, follows out the conclusions of the reason, but undoes them again to arrive at different or quite opposite conclusions, and continues indefinitely, if not ad infinitum, this process. This is the history of human thought and human endeavor, a constant breaking of bounds, only to move always in the same spirals, enlarged, perhaps, but following the same or constantly similar curves of direction. The mind of humanity, ever seeking, ever active, never arrives at a firmly settled reality of life's aims and objectives, or at a settled reality of its own certitudes and convictions, an established foundation or firm foundation of its idea of existence.
So Sri Aurobindo is elaborating that first paragraph in these two paragraphs by introducing this, topology of the mind, you may say. And it's interesting that he begins by talking about this layered kind of discontinuous structure of the mind, which is, one may say, the faculty that defines the human and gives it a species uniqueness. The rest of the being. So as we know, Sri Aurobindo talks about physical being, a vital being, and a mental being. And the physical being, of course, is the material world and all its physical objective realities. with consciousness latent within it. There is a latency of consciousness, but the inorganic and inconscient is its primary property. In terms of what are called the gunas, it manifests tamas more than anything else, but runs in grooves of habit or of, you know, laws of the inconscience. Then there is the vital, which is the life world and the life principle, which manifests within matter as the whole phenomenon of life. And this phenomenon is characterized by the guna of rajas, which is a kind of, you know, sort of constantly changing, you know, seeking for variety, novelty, and the fulfillment of desires. It's the desire world, the world of fulfilling desires. And this world, too, though, falls within the property of the material world up until the appearance of mind. And it's really the mind which changes in a way, transforms, and is transformed itself by entering into matter and taking on the property of life in thinking sentient beings in a full sense with the human. Because if we look at the kind of rudimentary mind that is possessed by the animal world, or the latency of mind possessed by the plant world, we find that the life forces, the forces of the vital, are under the constraints of the habitual movements of the physical in those cases. This is the reason why there is a much greater closeness to what we call nature in plants and animals. They form a certain kind of harmony with the seasonal life of the earth, so to say. And if they are run by desires, those desires don't run rampant. They're subject to the seasons. They're subject to the cycles of the material world, of the physical world. It's only with the appearance of mind that there is a rupture, as it were, with this, you know, habitual nature of the physical world. And even the life world becomes suddenly freed from its subjection to matter to a large extent, so that our desires run away with us. Human beings have unseasonal desires. Our desires are not bound by any kind of, you know, habit. They form their or create their own habits. And they have an independence which allows a certain kind of disturbance to enter into the more unconscious conditions of the manifestation of life in matter. So this is why when we talk about the human being, we start, Sri Aurobindo starts by talking about the tripartite nature of the mind. He's not talking about just the body or the emotions, etc. Even the emotions are really mentalized vital things as far as the human being is concerned. See? So also, it's very important to note that this idea of kind of continuing the evolution or the expression of different orders of consciousness from one level to the other is accomplished through certain structures within each of these orders of consciousness that maps onto the other orders. So when we kind of the unfinished movement of life is passed on into the realm of mind, once it enters into the creation and assumes physical and vital properties, so that the mind now has its correlates relative to the physical and the vital. It has a physical mind, a vital mind, and a mind proper. And so these are the things that Sri Aurobindo is looking at over here, at the mental life, which itself is influenced by and in intimate connection with the physical life and the vital life. And that's what we experience in a certain kind of a developmental scale. Now, one may say that if we look at that first paragraph, at the outset, man lives in his physical mind, which perceives the actual, the physical, the objective, and accepts it as fact. We may say that that outset is not necessarily a kind of a historical and anthropological outset, because the question may be raised about the horizon of primitive man as being one which is in some sense more vitalistic, more animistic, and therefore closer to the vital mind than a physical mind which is stuck to the senses and the evidence of the senses. This outset that he's talking about is more the outset of modern man. It is the outset of a world that has already decided that we have to find a common datum for our humanity, and that common datum is found in making a principled break from our vital life and trusting only the physical world. So that there is a certain kind of materialism related to the mind's focus or concentration on its state of being. This is the waking state in its most material form, one may say. And our times are characterized by that. This is a modern outset, one may say. So that kind of a condition, we cannot really recover the condition of the primitive man, because the primitive man was to some extent like this, and to some extent conditioned and, you know, sort of influenced in a very major way by beings who were wise and connected to both an animistic and a spiritual nature, so that society had other norms and other forms of upbringing from the very initial stages of life. And society had other kinds of experience. Ontology was different. But if we take our own condition, this is exactly the developmental psychology of modern man, where we start with a given, which is much more the external material world, so that if we have the awakening of philosophy in us, it more quickly asks the question, what are the origins of this material universe, rather than asking the question, what are the origins of subjectivity and consciousness? It assumes that consciousness is a kind of a property that emerges and that is given as a correlate of the objective material world. But even that kind of condition is, as he points out over here, constantly beset by the rampant freedom of the vital, which, if it gets even the slightest leeway, breaks all bounds to satisfy its own needs and desires. So this unquiet condition, you know, that Sri Aurobindo seasonally in Savitri compares to the monsoon, which comes in like a neighing horse and ruptures the, you know, the condition of the somnolent earth during the summer season. That is what the vital does. And by doing that every now and then, it creates new needs in us. And then he points to the mind proper, which has the same kind of relativity. It tries to make sense of this condition in which we find ourselves, both of the vital as well as of the physical. And it builds its constructions of, understanding. But all these constructions of understanding are problematic because they seem to be provisional schemes only that answer certain types of problems, but are beset with new problems that topple their certainty. So this is the way in which Sri Aurobindo sets up the problem in these two paragraphs.
If I may, this is a bit of a side tangent, but I'm going to say that I was recently in a conversation with someone who was describing meeting with a group of hunters in an Indonesian rainforest, and that the seeming experience of these relatively sort of not technologically, this was a Westerner, very much just a part of a Western experience, but suddenly just coming into the field of these people that are serving or practicing the intelligence of the jungle. And it seemed as though there was this difference between the way that they were interacting very intelligently within this rainforest context, and then the way that Western mind, if we will, I mean, perhaps this is too, there's too much of a kind of dialectic here, but still that there was simply at this point a kind of extremism of this, of the Western mind that simply would just come in and bulldoze the jungle as opposed to the intelligence of the jungle, that kind of living intelligence of the rainforest coupled with an intelligent walking through the rainforest in that, I suppose we could call it a primitive state. And perhaps this is just a comment, but that was perhaps the way that I was thinking of a more primitive, vital, animistic kind of conception. And I contribute that. I don't know, perhaps there is a thought to that.
Yeah, you know, absolutely, Justin. I think it's very appropriate. And it's exactly, I was trying to bring that kind of background to this, these two paragraphs, because I do believe that what Sri Aurobindo is talking about over here is the outset of our modern ontology, where there has been a certain kind of deliberate focus of consciousness towards the material world that has built a distance. You talked about whether there's too much of a dialectic. I think that dialectic is a historical happenstance. We have built a distance between our material existence and our animistic or vital existence. And that is partly why this kind of a ranging through the laws of the vital world is alien to us today.
It's Thank you. And I will add a sense that when this hunting party of indigenous inhabitants of the jungle were moving, the description seemed to convey a kind of symbolic awareness that not only were we moving, that they were moving in this, their so-called primitives were moving in a physical way through the forest, but also in a symbolic way, were deeply involved in a kind of symbolic relationship as well as a physical relationship.
Sure. And that is where, you know, these two states of being that we are talking about, the waking and the dream states, become much more enmeshed in each other. One dreams within the waking state, as it were, or one follows the dream logic, which is part of the immanence of the waking state. That kind of collapse of the boundaries is part of the integral life. You know, to kind of hold it from us by a taboo of sorts or a refusal is the condition of a building of a knowledge which tries through its own provisionality to arrive at adequacy with the world, but fails.
So if there are no other questions, shall we stop for today and continue next time?
Sure. Now, next time is what day? Next time would probably not happen. Next time is going to be May 14th.
Just a second.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, yes, yes.
So May 14th is most probably not going to be possible because I'll be in transit at that time. But the time after that, which is May 21st, should be possible.
28.
Is it May 28? May 28, that should be possible.
Okay.